related to some of the topics we spoke about earlier in the year, having talked about Prizbol and Varim Shibalev and Binyanim and a few other things that interact with this subject. So the suggestion was that we should give some head-on attention to Mechiras Chametz. So happy to do that. And through that, hopefully we'll get a little bit of clarity both about some of the central inyanim and some of the practices that we have witnessed throughout our lives in a Pesach context. And also, as noted, it will reflect back on some of the sugyas that we have seen throughout the year. So let's first begin by acknowledging that there is some controversy about Mechiras Chametz, and that there's also, unfortunately, maybe the one thing worse than controversy, because we are wary of machlokes, but we also recognize that that's a part of the process, that we also have to consider all the angles of everything, and that sometimes does lead to machlokes l'shem shamayim. But what is never l'shem shamayim and doesn't have any place in our avodah is cynicism. And there has certainly been some cynicism that is sometimes brought towards the Mechiras Chametz process, as represented by the individual that will come to me for Pesach and say, okay, Rabbi, I'm here to sell my Chametz, right? Wink, wink, we all know what that means. So let's just go through with it, ha, ha, ha. So that attitude of not taking it seriously and not coming with sincerity is corrosive and not good for us. So it's important that, just like we did by some of the other topics, that we come to try to understand how it is, if it is, we won't prejudge anything, but if it is and how it is, that Mechiras Chametz is something that we should be embracing, if that is indeed the case. So we'll also acknowledge a joke that perhaps represents some of the cynicism that connects to this, that it's said that the rabbis are going to prohibit smoking, but the Orthodox Jews aren't worried because they'll sell their lungs to a non-Jew. So, for the record, that does not work. So, why does it not work? So, what's the issues? There's actually two different issues with that. And maybe if you can identify them, so you'll have a little bit of an introduction to the controversy that surrounds Mechiras Chametz. So what would you say? There's two distinct issues. Eric?
Well, is there maybe like a legal element? Like, I know one of the things that makes Mechiras Chametz a lot stronger is the fact that if I were to touch my Chametz, this person could then like sue me or try me for stealing their property. And so there's a heavy legal element that's also enforcing the Mechiras Chametz, versus someone paid me for my lung, it's still my body and they can't access it. And if they were to try to take it, it'd be a black market thing and you're not allowed to do that. Like, the legal implications are not, you know, Jonah could elaborate more on that, but the legal implications are not on your side.
Jonah, I don't know what it is we've been trying, but right. Apparently...
I'm heavily involved.
Because it's also medical things.
Yeah, that's true. But it's also that it never leaves your possession. So in a sense, selling that chametz, if it's in a closet in my house, how much is that leaving your possession?
Okay, so what Eric and Jonah are saying is all connected to the same point, which is all a part of one basic issue here, is that in what sense would you be able to consider it sold? If there's no actual access the purchaser is going to have, and it doesn't change in any way, there's not going to be any real-world impact for the rest of your life of the fact that you have, and presumably after your life, for the fact that you have sold your lung. So in what sense can you ever be said to have sold it? And therefore, does that not constitute what's known as a sham, essentially a completely fake sale? And that is certainly one of the problems. Eric, I think you also started to mention about legal issues, which is related but not even necessary, but you're right, that if that's what you meant, that the sale would even face obstacles just as far as its reality. I'm not sure if that's what you meant or not, but it's certainly illegal and against public policy to sell your organs, when certainly organs that are vital for existence. So it would run into legal problems of that sort also. But that's perhaps all a part of a cluster of observations which all connect to the same point, that there's no reality to the statement that you have sold your lung to anyone else. Didija, you have a comment?
Yeah, I was just going to say, because for the chametz, he could, in all intents and purposes, just walk into your house.
We haven't gotten to the chametz yet. We haven't gotten to trying to figure out the chametz yet. But in terms of what we can derive from this joke, you know, what kind of weaknesses does it highlight, and then we'll try to see how much it applies. So that'll be our next step, or along the way. But first, I just want to identify what are potential problems. Yes, sir.
So I think the legal element is important in and of itself, because when you talk about the idea that Mekeres Chametz, when it comes to Mekeres Chametz, like on Pesach, you're not allowed to own the Chametz, and that maybe there's the possibility that it's halakhically impossible to even to have ownership over the Chametz. So fine, I have it in my house, you know, like legally I own it. So then the practical implication is the legal element of it, the legal owning of it. So therefore, Mekeres Chametz is taking away our last bit of any chazakah of any type.
Right, so you are jumping way ahead of us.
Okay.
So you're bringing in all kinds of points which are relevant and important and have some truth to them, but it's way ahead of where we're at right now. So let's just try to identify the issues, and then we'll try to start working out some of those points. So everything you said so far is relevant to one of the issues with the selling of lungs. So that is the question of, could there be any reality to such a sale, and by what sense of the word would that sale mean anything? What else is a problem with that joke? Or what else does that joke reveal as a problem? What else is the issue? Caleb?
Well, it kind of implies that you can become putzer from all mitzvot and commit as many of your as you want to. You sell the respective parts of yourself, or even yourself entirely, to someone.
Well, but even just more directly, let's say in terms of the issue of smoking and selling your lungs and a prohibition of smoking. So the joke is highlighting a certain problem, which may apply in other issues.
You're still smoking,
right? What would you? I don't mean that in a complimentary sense. Like what would that accomplish as far as? So here we'll turn to our medical experts, right? So maybe that you can look at it from a medical perspective. So if it's dangerous to smoke, does it become any less dangerous if your lungs were property of someone else? No. So at best, and here it's really a stretch, but at best, you would maybe technically address the issue. Well, the joke is so extreme, you wouldn't even technically address the issue. But let's say at best you'd technically address the issue, but as far as the essence of the problem, it wouldn't be addressed at all. So that might illustrate on some level what you might call a spirit of the law, letter of the law issue. Although, again, it's at best, because it's hard to see why it's even the letter of the law. But let's say you were to make some kind of a case that, it's dangerous for me to put smoke in my lungs, so I'll make them somebody else's lungs. So somehow on paper, it's better. But, of course, it's not going to give you any more good health. So, therefore, it's something which fails on two levels. So let's try to consider those two levels as far as some of the opposition that we see and how we can understand that. Caleb.
Another thing is that even if the lungs belong to somebody else, it's still property damage.
Well, it's still your own damage. That's the thing. So it's not going to have any at all impact on your own health. The fact that you were trying to protect your health and you claim that your lungs belong to somebody else, so it's not going to make any difference. So essentially, there are two different failures that this joke reveals. One is that you are completely not doing anything to account for the intent of the law, which is to keep you healthy. And the sale itself is meaningless because it has no reality to it. They're not going to leave your body. They're not going to enter in any sense the possession of the non-Jew. So what does that sentence mean? Essentially, nothing. So those two arguments are central to some of the debate about Mechiras Chametz. And earlier in the year, in the context of Pizbul and other such things, we talked about the hey word, harama. So the issue of harama is a fundamental question here. And the problem is that there are at least three ways to translate harama. And really is there's 20 ways to translate harama. But what I mean by saying three ways is that they could be grouped into three columns, meaning that harama could essentially have a neutral meaning or a negative meaning. And if it has a negative meaning, there are two different types of negative meanings it could have, which, when considering mechiras chametz, gives us four possibilities. Right? Because it could be that mechiras chametz is a harama, but that's neutral. It could be it's harama and that's negative of one type. Could be that it's harama and that's negative of a second type. Or it could be it's not a harama at all, which is the position that many have taken. So essentially, we have to be aware of all of those four possibilities when considering Mechiras Chametz, and then also to be aware of the very likely possibility that it's not any one or the other inherently, but that it's going to be very detail dependent. And how it actually plays out, and the relationship that we have to the Chametz, and to the process of selling the chametz, is going to probably be the most important detail. So the two negative meanings of harama and the neutral meaning, so as reflected by what we said, harama is sometimes interpreted as some kind of an evasion, some way of escaping your actual responsibilities. So that is relevant to the whole letter of the law, spirit of the law distinction, that it might be something which fits the letter of the law, but is inconsistent with the spirit of the law. That's a possibility. So that would be termed as harama in the sense of escaping something, evading something in an inappropriate way. Alternatively, harama is sometimes being clearly used in some contexts as a sham, meaning that it has a connotation of falsehood, of fakery, and it means that it's not what it claims to be. So if we are talking about a sale here, but it is not a sale in any real sense of the word, so then that would be maybe what some mean when they talk about harama. The neutral meaning would be that we're talking about avoiding a problem. It sometimes has the connotation of saying, okay, this path is challenging, so go around it and take that path. And sometimes that doesn't necessarily have any negative connotations, because sometimes there's nothing wrong with simply taking another path and avoiding whatever it is that's complicating your situation, especially if there is a major challenge with the straight path. And that's not necessarily the case here, but sometimes it is. And sometimes in other contexts in the Talmud where harama comes up, that might be the case. So therefore, in order to avoid what might otherwise be a challenging or maybe even unworkable situation, so you're told to go around. So that would be kind of a neutral meaning. Ezra?
How is that different than evasion?
Well, there is a fundamental difference. Let me phrase it this way. So to use the language of tax attorney, it would be the difference between tax evasion and tax avoidance. And tax evasion is a felony, and tax avoidance is a permissible strategy. Now, I don't know if that answers your question yet, but it just starts to frame it. That essentially, I don't know anyone here, if you're taking accounting, maybe you may have a better understanding. But essentially, in that context of tax evasion and tax avoidance, so the tax attorneys have a quote that's attributed to Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, but apparently he didn't really say it. So it's just a made-up kind of, probably just a made-up kind of illustration that has nothing to do with him. But he talked about how, let's say if you were on a bridge, and the bridge has a toll, and you went by without paying the toll, so that would be evasion. He doesn't use this example, but there's a car outside that's parked every day with a mannequin inside. I have no idea why, but sometimes, I don't know what that accomplishes, but sometimes people use the mannequin so that they can drive in the carpool lane, right? So that would be basically falsehood. So you're trying to, let's say that the carpool lane doesn't charge you toll, so that would be an evasion of the toll, that you're really obligated to pay the toll, but you're playing some game to get out of it, so that would be an evasion in the negative sense. But in the example that's attributed to Brandeis, so let's say to avoid paying the toll, you took the long way around and used the free bridge. So that would be avoidance, and that wouldn't be any problem. Now, in the context of taxes, that's brought up to represent something which may or may not fit, because it's going to be a subjectivity. But there are certain activities which might be taxable, and you may have the ability to frame them in a different way, maybe honestly so, in a category that's not taxed, let's say. So whether that's legitimate or not sometimes gets subjective, which is a part of the issue here. So I don't know if that answers your question, because it still leaves a lot of holes, but just the beginning of an answer. Yeah.
When we talk about potential negatives by taking the straight path, but if I understood correctly, like you said, there maybe wouldn't be, and like perhaps it would depend on the scenario, or what does it mean? Are these negatives like halachic negatives, or like
they could be
human,
any of the
like
above.
Like financial negatives? Because like maybe not so much in a personal home perspective, though maybe in a personal home. But let's say like you own a whiskey.
So we haven't gotten to any of the details yet. So let's try to do that. Now, before I say anything more about the Harama question and the fundamental definitions, so I gave you today makoros to look at that are all about chametz in one form or another. I didn't give you anything that was about the broader Harama question. Leaning at it for tomorrow, a little longer seder, we'll give you at least one or two sources to look at that address that, and that will help to be a contrast or a instruction as far as how to understand the relevance. But given those possibilities, so that gives us, to restate, four possibilities of how to relate to Mechiras Chametz, and maybe eight possibilities, because any of the four may or may not be true depending on the circumstances. So given that they all could flip, but the four possible categories would be, it's not a harama at all. It's a harama, but that's okay. It's a harama in the sense of an evasion of the mitzvah. It's not really the appropriate way to deal with the Torah's commandments regarding chametz, even if it satisfies the letter of the law. Or it's an evasion in the sense that it's fake and the sale is insincere. And that could open up bigger questions of maybe it doesn't even have any effect and just leaves you in ownership of the chametz. Or maybe somewhere in between, maybe it joins with the previous issue and that, okay, maybe it's real enough to satisfy the letter of the law, but not real enough to be genuine and be satisfactory to God in the full sense of the word. So there are different permutations of that last possibility. So we're all clear on those four possibilities. And again, especially the last two may be very much detail dependent. And it may be that if you switch some of the details of some of the attitudes, it may flip from one column to the other. But potentially, those are the four issues. So the four possibilities. So the question of how to relate to Mechiras Chametz, Shabbos Manenu, is a controversy that has raged for at least the past 300 years, but really, as we'll see, was addressed significantly earlier than that, and starts really from a Tosefta which is quoted in the Talmud Yerushalmi, and also in one form or another in the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, and which on the surface seems to be the basis for what we do today, and may leave you with a question of, well, what actually is the problem then? Because don't we have a pretty direct source in Shas for our contemporary practice? So what does the Tosefta describe? Anyone help me out? Right, well, in terms of this situation, what does it describe? So a person is on a boat, and he has his chametz with him.
Right? Is it the same? Is it the same thing as the Rambam?
We went straight to the Rambam. Yeah. So it's tell me from the Rambam what it describes.
A person's on a boat, and Pesach is coming. Like it's about to be the time where it's also the own chametz. So the person goes and sells the chametz to the non-Jew, and like the general idea is that it has to be a real full, or I guess a matana, but it has to be a real full transfer.
So the last part is going to be the disputed part, because that's getting a little further, but the first part of the scenario, so he's on the boat, right, and Pesach is looming, and somehow he has to deal with the fact that he has his chametz with him. So how can he handle that? Apparently, he can transfer it to a non-Jewish fellow traveler. And through doing that, that will apparently save him from both the violation over the course of Pesach of Ba'ira Ba'imatzeh, and also the post-Pesach consequence of Chametz Shavu of a Pesach, which are not always habaha. Generally, they are. So let's assume that they are going together here, and you're trying to avoid both problems, and apparently this will do it. Sam?
And I think, like, one of the things we talked about, we noted was, like, it could, I guess the Ram, but or the Tosefta in this, like, in its original, like, could have said, and throw the chametz overboard.
Right, so clearly you could figure that out on your own.
Yeah.
But you don't want to do that, right? So that's clearly the subtext here. That, yes, if a person wants to just throw his chametz away, so he always has that option. But the premise here seems to be that he doesn't want to, and perhaps he can't, let's say, from an economic perspective. Eric?
Does the ideas we're talking about in the first comments relate to, like, the reason we have it? Like, maybe it's, like, it's a gezeira that we have here from the Torah to stop us from eating it? Or the idea that it shouldn't even be owned, like there's something innate in the fact that it's not even owned.
I think you are asking very important questions. I think that's something that we will get to, and it will become very fundamental. We're not there yet. But the question, you're right, it's a very, very, very much at the core, I think, of some of the issues that connect to this. So God willing, we'll get to it. So that's the scenario that's described, that you can transfer the ownership to this non-Jewish fellow traveler and reacquire it after Pesach. So if that's the case, so then why is there any controversy? This wasn't just made up in 1950. So this is something which seems to be described by the Tosefta and codified by halacha by the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch. So this is radio out black letter law. So why is there any controversy about this, Sam?
I guess like two things off, like, like first, maybe this is like an Eitzara type of scenario.
Okay, so one point, maybe this was never meant to be utilized in the standard pre-planned way that we do today. And maybe the story is being told in a certain way in order to convey that this is a urgent situation for this individual that just came up. Second point?
The second point was that the way in which it's being described, how the sailor gift is being done, just doesn't obviously seem to be the same as how we go about it. That, like, it seems perhaps what they're doing just on the surface level looks more like a full transfer, a full gift, where people might look at what we're doing today and say, it's in your house, like what you're...
Okay, so those are issues which are relevant, although we don't necessarily know from the Tosefta that it's different. There are questions that are brought up against our contemporary practice, but I don't know if we necessarily see that from the source. Shlomo Elieli Shlomo?
I think the words in the Tosefta of Rotanak Mura make was an issue to this, because, again...
So we don't know that word is in the Tosefta itself, though.
It might not be.
So that we have to. So there's a condition that we're going to have to try to clarify.
All of it is. Mm-hmm. It seems difficult to believe, at least the contemporary way in which we do this, the sale of the first chametz, that it is initially like irrevocable, when our intent selling it today is to get it back in 8 days.
Okay, so that's going to bring out major issues. We have to figure out, just to break down that sentence that you said, what it touches upon. So we have to figure out if our contemporary practice is consistent with whatever the Tosefta, with the way the Rishonim codify it, the whole process from the Tosefta to, let's say, Shulchan Aruch, from that span. So the way we do it today, does it meet that threshold? That's an important question. And it's also just a factual question of how do we do it today, which is not necessarily well-known or obvious to everybody. So that is a two-part issue that we'll have to clarify. So then your own Benidija, in alphabetical order.
I was going to say that, like, part of it goes back to the Tosefta could have said, so just chuck it overboard. It tells you that the solution is to sell to someone else, mm-hmm. even though it's an ace tzara, let's say. I guess nowadays it would be a similar situation. So every year, right before Pesach, everyone's supposed to just dump, like, get rid of all chametz they own. Like, that would be seemingly something like that every year.
Theoretically, they could, and many people do.
Right.
So it's not obvious that that's a problem. But it seemed to be a case for, it seems to be the case for the guy in the boat. But yeah, maybe in a chanami, maybe that is what otherwise you'd be expected to do. Maybe. Did you?
Similar to what Eli was saying, it seems like, again, not with the mechanisms per se, the halachic mechanisms, but it just seems like you're sort of nowadays, unless a genuine way of doing it because it's more industrialized. Opposed to this example where it's like, okay, and you know a guy, you say like, okay, you could come in, I'm selling you a thing, take whatever I want. Now it's like, okay, Kenyan Sudar, check. Can you rabbi? Like, it's more industrialized. It seems less genuine.
What do you mean when you say industrialized? What do you
like
mean?
It's on a grand scale. Like, everyone goes to the rabbi and then does it for everybody. It's supposed to like, oh, I know a guy. Okay, so you go to him and be like, okay, buy my chametz. Like, that's what it seems like from the Tosefta.
It seems to be more formalized, maybe, or more.
I would say more industrialized. More.
Okay, it's an interesting word to use, but I guess you mean that it's something that is now given permanence and planning, which seems to be different from what is described in the story.
Right.
Okay, Eric?
Does the story imply that you're going to get it back?
It says you get it back.
Okay, fine, because then it would seem like it just, like, fly their own word, and you could just sell it or give it to someone.
Yeah, if you could sell it for a profit, then you might do that. Yeah. But that's already described in the Mishnah. Right? Although it's a machlokas beisol and beishamayin, if you sell it, so you have to sell it with enough time before Pesach that you can reasonably assume that he will eat it before Pesach. But we assume, like beisol, that if you're going to sell it and just say goodbye to it forever, so then that's not a problem. The issue is going to come with our scenario, which, as Eli was alluding to, that we end up reuniting with the chametz, which is not yet a problem as far as the Tosefta is concerned, but we don't know if all the details are going to match in a way that is satisfactory. Okay, so basically, just to kind of set up a little more, and then we're going to run out of time, so I'll give you some direction for tomorrow, so you know what to be thinking about, what to be looking at. So you've seen this Tosefta, or you certainly will have seen it by tomorrow, and you've seen the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch that bring it. So the question of how do we account for all the details here? And there is a phrase which may or may not appear in the original Tosefta. It comes up in the Rishonim, and it's not clear if the Rishonim put it in or if it was maybe a Girsa in the Tosefta. But one way or another, it ends up being a major part of the halachic debate by the time you get to the Rishonim, that they say you can do this. This is recorded halacha. This is acceptable. On one condition. Ubilvad shelo yarim. As long as it's not a harama. So that is a little hard to understand. In the words of Rabbeinu Yerucham, who's quoted by the Beis Yosef, you're basically saying you can do this harama as long as it's not a harama. And that's basically how the Rabbeinu Yerucham asks. He says, what do you mean as long as it's not a harama? The whole thing is a harama. So what does it mean that you can do this harama as long as it's not a haram? So the question of harama by Mechiras Chametz was already addressed head-on by these Rishonim and setting down rules as how to prevent it from being that. So what you'll see is that there are a number of interpretations as to what that phrase means, at least three. There are at least three ways to understand what that phrase means, and we'll have to see how well it works for us in terms of our contemporary practice. And what I will add is that a few hundred years later, after these Rishonim debated it, so this issue was really given new fire to the, more fuel to the fire, by the Bechor Shor. The Bechor Shor, not the Rishon, the Bechor Shor, but there was an Achron of Alexander Shor, who was maybe more well known for a sefer in Shechita called Tzvuas Shor, and he was very influential, as we'll see as far as this discussion. And he maintained that Mechiras Chametz is a harama. Although, if that was his conclusion or not, I'll have to hedge a little bit, because that may be a somewhat of a misquote. But for now, for the beginning of the discussion, let's take it that way. They said Mechiras Chametz is a harama. He then had two other premises, which we'll have to discuss tomorrow in terms of their accuracy. So by tomorrow, you will have seen many more makoros, and you'll be very prepared to discuss this. He claims that there is a rule about haramas. And that rule is that it is only allowed or effective, that may be a key difference, but it's only allowed or effective when dealing with rabbinic law. You only can use haramas for dinim derabbanan. And he says that based on the Gemara. By tomorrow you will have seen the Gemara, so you'll tell me what you think about the comparison. But that is essentially his premise, premise number two. And if that's the case, so what does that do for our ability to sell chametz? What would you say?
It makes it null and void.
Makes it null and void. Why does it make it null and void?
There is a...
Because
we have... Yes, say it again. Because each one can take one iser. It's... So we seem to have Yisurim Daraisa that apply to our chametz. Now, the Bechor Shor actually doesn't conclude that way, and there's maybe even more to this conclusion, I'm not saying, but he takes another controversial premise here, that our chametz in our houses is only us and Midrabbanan. Why would that be?
Bittul?
So the issue is bittul. Now, that we'll discuss tomorrow also is a controversial application, but that's where he's coming from, that because bittul is there, so then that knocks down our chametz to an issur d'rabbanan, and therefore this harama of mechiras chametz could be valid. Caleb?
But bittul means that we don't own it. Stop.
Okay, you're right that there's going to be a big problem with applying bittul here, and that premise is going to be maybe the most controversial of the three premises. Natana?
Isn't the chametz what we had mentioned so that would mean that I don't actually own it on a Doraisa standpoint to begin with.
Well, it, maybe. Yes and no. It could have meant that conceptually. The problem is that that's what that Gemara is addressing, meaning that you're going back to the Gittin Isra Hana question, that there is a fundamental problem with having an Isra of owning chametz, and yet we seem to. So that is what that Gemara is addressing and saying that despite the fact that there is a conceptual problem with owning it, but al pidin, we do own it for the purposes of Bayra Bayi Matzah. Now, if we were really able to spend a full month on chametz and the Isser, I mean, which I guess that's what Shloshim Mekorim Machag is for, but still, I would highlight that it's also relevant that the Torah doesn't actually phrase the Isser in the Lashon of ownership. It's Balyura and Balyimatse, which we assume to be the ingredients of ownership, so therefore it's Ke'ilu, the Torah says, don't own chametz on Pesach. It doesn't actually use those words, which the truth is could answer some of the conceptual questions. But, gliding over that for now, So what we have is a iser to own chametz on Pesach for practical purposes, and that seems to be an iser daraisa. And here the Bechor Shor is maintaining that because you have bittul, it knocks it down to a drabanan, so the harama of mechiras chametz could work. That, as Caleb's alluded to already, is a controversial premise, and many, for good reason, don't agree with that. But that is his three-part premise. So what we're going to see tomorrow, just after quickly, we'll see tomorrow, is we're going to consider the following things. So when you look at the Makaros, the ones that you haven't gotten to yet today, and the ones I'm going to add, you have a lot of work to do for tomorrow's Seder, so make sure to use the time well. Here are the questions you're going to want to look for. So first of all, the condition, whether it's from the Tosefta, the Rishonim, of Ubovad Shalo Yarim, what does that mean practically? What does that translate to? How do we stop it? It sounds like there, the whole question of is Mechiras Chametz a Harama or not, it sounds like it was addressed by the Rishonim, and the answer is, it depends. It depends on what? So there are at least three approaches to that. So tomorrow we'll get some perspective of that. And like you, I'll also send you the text of the Bechor Shor so you can read it inside. But the three premises of the Bechor Shor, you will evaluate, and you think that his, let's say, his second premise, that there's a rule that haramas can only be used for drabanans, is that correct? And the third premise, that bittul makes this an issa drabanan, is that correct? So you'll consider both of those issues. And there are actually four ways to relate the halacha to the Bechor Shor. And today, whether people are aware of the Bechor Shor or not, many people are, because it had a major influence, or many halachists are, because it had a big influence on the whole discussion. But there are basically four approaches, and we'll just close with this, four ways to deal with it halachically. There are those who accept everything the Bechor Shor wrote on this, all three premises. There are those who disagree with all three premises. We said each one could be controversial. So, for example, the Chassam Sofer was one of the major Bali Plukta here, and he basically disagreed with all three premises. That's not a harama, and there's no rule saying that haramas could only be by drabanas anyway. And we don't agree that bittul knocks it down to a drabanas. You could easily disagree with all three. So there are some who agree with all three, and some who disagree with all three. Then there's a split l'chumra and a split l'kula. So the split l'chumra probably represents the way many do assume today, even though they're not necessarily aware of the Bechor Shor, but the elements of the position might be there. Meaning what? That you agree with, let's say, premise number one, that there's a harama here. Premise number two, that it's not right to use the harama in dealing with an iser daraisa. And they disagree with premise three, that bittul does not effectively turn this into an iser drabana. So what does that mean practically? Either it means that, okay, so don't use chametz for deraisas, just use it for drabanans. That is a policy that many do have today, whether or not they're aware of the Bechor Shor, but it is a policy that plays out. Or find another approach to declare it drabanan, but not necessarily assuming that bittul does the trick. And there are those who accept the Bechor Shor in a split way, lakula, meaning that they only focus on the last part, and they believe that bittul does knock it down to a drabanan. And based on that, say, okay, so we're only dealing with the Yisurim drabanan here, and therefore there's more license to be a little bit more makel about how the sale is carried out or what it represents. But others, again, being that that last premise is controversial, for good reason, so there are others who disagree with it, l'chumra, and say, no, you can't assume that you're only dealing with a derabbanan here because of bittul. You have to assume you're dealing with a daraisa. And yet, if mechiras chametz is an option, so then you have to man up and accept it on the level of minhag Torah and be very serious about it and don't allow yourself any kulas based on the premise that you're dealing with a derabbanan. So, God willing, we will look tomorrow at how all those parts come together. Looking very forward. Should have an amazing day.